Hello, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the reemergence of debtors' prisons and incarcerating the poor. My guest in this part of our program from Washington, D.C. is Eric Balaban. He is a senior staff counsel with the National Prison Project of the American Civil Liberties Union. And since joining the ACLU in 1994, he has represented over 75,000 prisoners in class action lawsuits challenging the unconstitutional conditions of confinement across the country. He currently serves as a class counsel in cases challenging unconstitutional conditions at the L.A. County Jail, the Maricopa County Jail, and the Broward County Jail, among others. Among his other major areas of legal action have been the steady rise in the incarceration of citizens in debt. He is the co-author of two national ACLU reports, Abandoned and Abused, Orleans Parish Prisoners in the Wake of Hurricane Katrina, and In for a Penny, The Rise of America's New Debtors' Prisons. More information on the ACLU's prison project can be found at ACLU.org. Nice to have you with us today, Eric.
Thank you for inviting me.
The number one target for private prison interest groups to capitalize on revenues from taxpayers is poor people who are unable to even pay the smallest of debts, not even the court fines or fees. And many of these people are already living off food stamps. They're in dire poverty. In Georgia alone, private companies have made about $40 million. And this is big business. But what I found particularly disturbing from one ACLU paper is that it is not only the private industrial prison complex that's being greatly rewarded, but also the probation services, which have also been privatized. And then these companies' monitoring fees are charged to the person who is in jail. In a terrible economy, most of these people are unable to find a job in the first place. So even if they did serve time in prison for, say, stealing some food to eat, they're still nevertheless living in a prisonized society. So what we are witnessing is a growing collaboration between private business interest and local and county governments, where both are benefiting financially. So I'd like for you to take us on this journey to show us, when did we return to debtors' prisons? Many of us thought that that ended over 100-plus years ago. And then adding on to that, when you examine how poor at least 100 million Americans are, and we now have evidence today that 4.4 million children are living in abject poverty, and at least 3.4 million of those don't even live on $2 a day. And that $2 a day is a figure that you never hear about Americans. You hear about people living in Africa, the Sudan, or Ethiopia. But now we have to put that in America. So how in the world is someone who has no money whatsoever, 18 million children food challenged, they don't have full food each day, many skip meals for a whole day, how in the world are they supposed to pay a fine when they're in jail, and then pay a probation officer, and pay court fees when they have compounding interest so they never get out of a debt and can be rearrested? It makes no sense to me. Could you please take us through this to put the pieces together? The forum is yours.
This is a serious problem. It's a growing problem in this country. It's one that most states, municipalities don't even sort of capture and have their hands around. But what we do know is that over 30 years ago, the United States Supreme Court, in a case called Bearden versus Georgia, held that a person could not be incarcerated simply because they were too poor to pay their court fines and fees. In that case, the plaintiff was a man named Danny Bearden, who had been arrested on burglary charges and had $750 in court fines and costs assessed against him as part of his criminal penalty. He was unemployed. He was illiterate at the time. He was able to keep up payments for a certain period of time, but then he fell behind and was arrested and incarcerated to serve the remaining 3 years of his sentence behind bars. He had been on probation while he was paying his fees. He remained in prison for close to 3 years before his case made it to the Supreme Court, and it was then that the Supreme Court in his case held that a state could not incarcerate a probationer who, through no fault of his own, couldn't pay his fines and fees. Rather, the courts had to inquire into the reasons why Mr. Bearden and others could not pay those legal financial obligations, or LFOs. And if the reason was non-willful, if they simply were too poor to pay, they could not be incarcerated. And despite the finding in Bearden, despite the creation of state laws throughout the country that ban debtors' prisons, they are thriving in this country. In 2009, the ACLU of Michigan was contacted by a woman named Edwina Nolan after she was jailed because she failed to comply with a court order to pay about $100 a month in lodging fees to the detention center that held her son. At the time the court entered that order, Ms. Nolan was homeless and she was working part-time. She was only released from jail after the ACLU of Michigan agreed to represent her and filed an emergency petition on her behalf. Ms. Nolan's case got a great deal of press in Michigan and even got some coverage nationally, and it was really her case that sparked the national ACLU to consider how big of a problem this was around the country. And in 2009 through 2010, we, along with the Brennan Center for Justice, part of New York University, did a systematic review of debtors' prisons practices in states around the country. And what we found after our year-long investigation, we produced our findings in the report you mentioned. The Brennan Center produced a report the same day. We looked at 5 states. The Brennan Center looked at 15 states and found that in every state, we studied, courts imposed fines and fees on criminal defendants without inquiring into their ability to pay. They jailed those who failed to pay their fines and fees, even when their failure to pay wasn't willful. More recently, the ACLU of Ohio looked at the practices in its state and found in 7 of the 11 counties that they investigated that the courts failed to follow the Ohio Constitution and state law requiring both an inquiry into a criminal defendant's ability to pay these fines and fees, and then a hearing with counsel present if they failed to pay to determine if that failure was willful. Most recently in Missouri, prompted by some of the events in Ferguson, Missouri, there was a report produced by the Arch City Defenders who represent defendants in municipal courts. These are very small courts that generally handle traffic-related offenses that are a massive engine towards debtors' prisons in that state and elsewhere. And in that report, the Arch City Defenders found that in 30 of the 60 municipal courts covered, there was no determination of willfulness. There was no indigency determination. In most cases, judges did not inform defendants of their right to have an attorney present. In most cases, attorneys weren't present. So this is a huge problem that's been growing. We also know that since 2010, 48 states have increased their criminal and civil court fees. In 44 states, probationers can now be charged for the cost of their probation, and this includes administrative fees to those private probation companies you mentioned at the top of the show. And in 43 states, criminal defendants can even be billed for the cost of their public defender. In the end, this has all resulted in an explosion of debtors' prisons around the country. Again, we don't have good national statistics. We only know about the jurisdictions we've studied. But, for example, in Huron County, Ohio, 23% of all jail bookings in 2012 were for unpaid fines and fees. In Benton County, Washington, a quarter of all jailed persons on misdemeanors were there for failing to pay their fines and fees. So this certainly is a huge and growing problem, and one that counties and states around the country simply don't have a handle on.
I appreciate the overview. Let's use some specific stories, and I'm sure you have many you could share with us, where someone did not commit a crime as we would know it, meaning they didn't rob someone, they didn't break into a home. Maybe they had a bill that wasn't paid, that they couldn't pay, not that they wouldn't want to. And then they were put in prison because of unpaid bills, having nothing to do with crime. But once you go into the jail, you're now, unfortunately, into that legal system where a future employer, seeing that you were in jail, wouldn't care whether or not you were in there for committing a hard crime or a soft crime or not being able to pay a bill. They're just, well, your former inmate. Tell us about how common is it for a person to be able to end up in jail for nothing more than being too poor to pay a bill?
Well, our focus has been on persons who have been arrested for low-level crimes, but certainly the problems of private debt collections now using the threat and reality of imprisonment is a real one. Again, it's not an area where states and municipalities are required to produce any statistics, where they keep any statistics. There has been work that has been done to try to expose these practices, but our work has been focused on persons who have been charged with very low-level offenses. These could be traffic offenses. These could be low-level nonviolent drug offenses, such as the possession of marijuana. And they result in these men and women end up being tethered to the criminal justice system for long periods of time. And I can certainly give you examples of that. There was an example we covered in our 2010 report of a gentleman by the name of Tory Tobias, who ended up trapped in the Orleans Parish, that's New Orleans, the Orleans Parish criminal justice system for almost 6 years after he pled guilty to possession of marijuana in 2004. Associated with his pleading guilty and being found guilty, he was assessed about $740 in fines and fees, and he made regular payments of about $25 to $50 a month to the court through 2005, which lowered his debt to about $400. When he fell behind in 2006, the court, as typically happens, issued a warrant for his arrest, and he was arrested in 2008. He was thrown into the Orleans Parish Prison, which is one of the harshest prisons in the country. It's been the subject of litigation over the past 40 years. He was released 18 days after being arrested and thrown in jail when he made a partial payment. He fell behind again in January of 2009. A year later, he was arrested again on a warrant, spent another 10 days in jail, and he lost his job after he was thrown into jail. He was only released when the court decided to waive the remaining fines and fees. In all, in order to collect $434, the city of New Orleans paid the sheriff of Orleans Parish $626 over 5 years to incarcerate him. And this is one critical aspect of debtors' prisons that most states and counties don't realize, that they end up spending far more in administrative costs and incarceration costs in the lost revenue and activity of those thrown into jail than they ever can hope to collect from those debtors who they end up imprisoning. So it ends up not being cost effective, even though it has been sold to the public as a means to collect much needed revenue.
When you look at how many people in New York City, where I'm broadcasting now, are stopped and searched, not because there's probable cause, but because they're people of color, and it's generally in poor neighborhoods, Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn and Brownsville or South Bronx, you never, ever, not once have you seen stop and search implemented on Wall Street. And yet there's about 300,000 people working down there and another 100,000 people living in that area. You never see them stopping and searching on the Upper West Side, such as West End and Riverside Drive, Central Park, unless it's someone who's come into the neighborhood and who looks suspicious, but not the people living there. And I live on the Upper West Side. We broadcast from the Upper West Side. We've never seen this, nor anyone that we've spoken to. You never see the stop and search in the theater district of tourists or residents or people working in the theater district. You never see people coming out of banks in affluent neighborhoods being stopped and searched. So for them, the authorities to say, well, this is not discrimination, it's not racial profiling, it begs an argument in the opposite direction. But here's my concern. They are now making what historically would have been a non-arrest into an arrest, or a non-summons into a summons, spitting on the sidewalk, walking against the light. So that means you're ready to walk, but the light isn't green yet, and there's no cars coming, so you walk. They'll give a fine for that or arrest for that. Little insignificant things that historic would never have been a problem. You might have been warned, but nothing more. Now we're criminalizing what historically been regular behavior. Could you address that? Because a lot of these people are the ones who are the poorest, and they're the ones that are profiled, and they're the ones who can't pay the bills and end up in debtors' prisons as well.
That certainly is true. And the other part of this is that, it is the poorest counties, the poorest towns that most view these fines and fees they assess associated with what could be called low-level offenses, nonviolent offenses, offenses, victimless offenses. They are the ones that are the most dependent upon this revenue and therefore the most aggressive in collection efforts. Again, I'd point back to Missouri, where there's, again, an excellent report on statewide practices in these municipal courts around the state. And what you have described in New York occurs in Missouri every day throughout the state. In that state, African Americans are pulled over for traffic offenses at a rate that's 63% greater than expected based on their proportion of the population, and that's a statistic that's established by the state's own attorney general. They're then subject to this system of fines and fees associated with these traffic stops that results in their being jailed for failure to pay. They're also, African Americans are disproportionately searched after a traffic stop in Missouri as well. In Ferguson, Missouri, African Americans are twice as likely to be searched following a stop as whites. And that's true even though contraband has been found incident to those searches of white suspects about a third of the time more often than in searches of black suspects. This is not empirically based on some racial aspect of criminal behavior. Whites are more likely to have contraband than blacks in Ferguson. And Ferguson isn't an outlier in the state. There's a tiny town of Belridge, Missouri, that in 2013, the year that they were studied, every single search and arrest originating from a traffic stop was of an African American. Not a single white who was stopped was searched. Not a single white was arrested. And again, this is this has unfortunate consequences. The consequences are is African Americans then disproportionately get tied up into this perverse system in the municipal courts, which places them at risk of being arrested and incarcerated simply because they're too poor to pay their fines and fees. These municipal courts themselves don't run like you would think a normal court runs. They tend to meet 2 or 3 days every month. The judges and prosecutors in those courts, they're not publicly appointed and they're not elected. They are appointed by commissioners or court administrators, and therefore it creates a system of perverse incentives for them to hold on to these jobs. They have to justify those positions, and they have to justify their salaries, which are substantial given the limited amount they work. And again, that creates at least an appearance of impropriety and a perverse incentive for them to be very aggressive in trying to collect fines and fees. And I mentioned again, this happens much more often in poorer towns and municipalities than wealthy ones. Again, going back to Missouri, I cite the example of the city of Pine Lawn, which is cited in the Arch City Defenders white paper, which I recommend that everyone read. The city of Pine Lawn is 96% black. It has a per capita income of $13,000. That city collected more than $1.7 million in fines and fees in 2013. By way of comparison, the suburb of Chesterfield, Missouri, with 15 times the population of Pine Lawn, a per capita income of $50,000, collected $500,000 less in municipal fees last year. So again, unfortunately, this most affects poor counties and poor towns, most affects persons of color. That's true in Missouri. That's true across the country. In Washington State, the state court, in fact, sponsored a review of its fines and fees system and found that in that state, Hispanic defendants were far more likely to receive higher fines and fees and a proportionally higher set of fines and fees than white defendants for the same crimes, and that higher fines and fees were apportioned to persons charged with and convicted of drug offenses than for those convicted of violent offenses. And Washington State is a state has a criminal justice system that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has found to be infused with racial bias. So this is a problem that affects communities of color around the country.
I have another issue I'd like for you to address, please. I went down to Florida because I heard that there were a group of homeless veterans living near Cape Canaveral in Titusville, Florida, not too far from Orlando. And I took my camera crew and I asked around, and everyone in the neighborhood knew that there were vets, and they were living in a small area that was owned by a person who decided never to build there but let people use it. And that's why they couldn't be dislodged by the police who wanted to get them out of there. And all the neighbors didn't want them. But when I asked the neighbors, have they committed any crimes, robbery, burglary, theft, violence, the answer was no. And they haven't done anything. And I said, well, then what is the problem? Why do you want them out of here? And they said that it was because the vets represented a stigma. It could bring down the value of their property, and that was the main reason, and also because they were poor. And it didn't feel good, they said, having poor people live around them. So I got the neighborhood feel on it before I talked with the first vet. I didn't know how many vets there would be. So when I went into the woods, and this was about 10 o'clock in the morning, I came upon a little cluster of tents. Now, I'm not talking about big tents. I'm talking about, you know, the kind of tiny little pup tent that kids would have and you put in your backyard for them to play in. Too big for an adult to get in. If you got in, half your body would be in, half your body would be out, from your waist down would be out. That's what they had. And I thought it odd because in one tent there were three sets of legs sticking out, and the top part of their body was in. And it was terrible because you could see all these mosquitoes, and their legs had all these sores on them. So anyhow, they got up, they talked with me. There were about, I'm going to guess, 12 people in that area. And all of them were vets. They all had had homes. They all had careers, welders and carpenters, plumbers, electricians. And they'd gone over to Afghanistan or to Iraq or both. And now when they came home, many of them, most of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And that emotional imbalance didn't allow them to reenter and live a normal life with their families. They would frequently exhibit depression or acute anxiety that can manifest in violence, screaming, yelling. And then when they couldn't associate with their family anymore, when there was nothing but arguments, they left or were told to leave. And that's when they started drinking or taking drugs. And then they, you know, as one guy said, look, if I'm going to be homeless, I'd rather be homeless where it's warm than homeless where it's freezing. So I came from Michigan down here. And another person said, we lived in Buffalo, and you don't want to know what it's like in the winter if you're poor and you're homeless to be in Buffalo. There's not enough beds in the centers. And all of them had similar stories. So they came down here, and they heard about where did the homeless vets go. And I said, well, how many are you? And they said, about 17,000. I said, where? Across the country? No, just here. And sure enough, in that area of Florida, there were 17,000 homeless vets. You wouldn't see them. They're in the woods. But then they told me their story, and I followed them through 48 hours. And it was true what they said, that they would get up in the morning, generally around 3 to 4 o'clock, and they would walk the 3 to 4 miles to the employment center. And that's where local contractors come by and hire people to get in the back of the truck and go to a construction site. But they had to fill out paperwork every morning, no matter how often they came. And they had a place, are you a vet? You know, and if you signed that you were a veteran, you never got called, even though you were more qualified than other people who didn't have that skill. And even if you weren't an alcoholic or taking drugs, and I met a lot who were not, fully capable of working. So by 6:30, when it was closed and all the work for the day was gone, you walk back. Mind you, had no money. None of these guys had money. I didn't meet one person down there in my entire stay interviewing more than 400 of them who had more than, I think one guy had 60 bucks. None of them had anything. And they would pull their money to get either food or beer. And one guy was unique. He had a very neat tent. He had his clothes folded neatly. And he had a patch on his chest, and it was all bloody. And I said, you have an infection there. He's, I know. And he lifted back the flap, and you could see that it had become septic. And I said, that is going to go to your heart. He said, well, 2 weeks ago, I got a heart stent put in, and I was given a prescription. He opened up this little folded, wadded piece of paper, and it was a prescription. It was for $68 for antibiotics. And he said, I don't have the money to get it. And because it's not if the VA says it's not related to combat, you don't get covered. And so he said, so I do what I can. I walk down each day to the beach, which is 5 miles. I then, where the people wash their sand off, I take a shower. I go into the water hoping that the salt water will help it. And then I come back, but it's getting worse. So needless to say, I took care of that and got him his, you know, the money he could get his stuff, and actually put him in a hotel for a couple of weeks so he could at least be in a better environment to get well. I don't know what's happened to him. But then they go each day to the Daily Bread. Now, this is a wonderful place where they receive no financial support from the community, the city, the federal government, the state. It's all based upon donations. But they give you, you can take a shower, you get a meal. They have some clothes that's donated that you can get. And they go there, they'll spend a couple hours there, then they go back. And what was interesting is how many women I spoke with. Dozens and dozens of women. And as one of them told the story, you know, when she came back and she had post-traumatic stress disorder, she couldn't identify with her family, and they told her to get out. And then when she got on the streets and had no money, then she got hassled by kids, teenagers. They got a kick out of, you know, beating up homeless people, and if they can rape you, they will. And she said, but the vets have a pledge of honor. You will never see one of these women being assaulted by another vet, because the women stay in the middle of a compound and the men in the ring, and they all have a ring around them, and they all have whistles. And this one woman said, if there's ever a hassle, I blow this whistle, 50 guys come running. And these are vets. And so there's a whole culture I didn't know existed. But here was the part that joins with what you're doing and saying, that I just gave the larger context. Every single vet had been hassled by the police. Most of them had been arrested. There is, between the walk that they do, there's a veterans park. Mind you, not a regular park, a veterans park. But they found out it's not allowed for a homeless vet to sit in the park. One gentleman said that he would go there and sit and read a book because there was a bench, and they don't have any benches. And he said he had gotten a ticket. Another vet had been arrested. Now, once they're arrested, they can spend a minimum of 90 days in jail, 3 months, or longer. And also, then it goes on their record. Then they can't get a work permit, and they can't get a driver's license. So it's a catch-22. And another one said that he lived by, a young guy in his late 20s, he said he lived by going in to orchards and stealing some fruit to eat, because there'd be days when there would be no food for any of the vets unless they went to the Daily Bread. But sometimes the Daily Bread ran out of food. So they were only meant to have 200 people. Now they got 800 people. So he said it's really rough. Then they had a stand down. Do you know what a stand down is?
I'm not sure in this context.
Okay, a stand down is where once a year, all of the former veterans, I found some from the Korean War, the Vietnam War, they come and donate their time to try to give some service or help to homeless vets. And when they told me about this, I got there early in the morning, and the mist was rising, and I didn't hear anything. I thought I was in the wrong location, but I was given an address, and I was there. It's a kind of like an abandoned road. And my goodness, when the sun rose and it burned off the dew, and I saw thousands of vets standing in line silently waiting for them at 7 o'clock to open the gate and let them in. They went into this huge field, and there were some boots, a sleeping bag. They could get a haircut and a shave. They could have a dentist look at their teeth. Couldn't do anything, but it could tell them what they needed. They had some doctors, all volunteers. None of this was by the federal government, and they all looked forward to it. But there was a big truck, and they were given out shopping bags of food at church, a regular church. And when I was talking with the woman who ran this, she said, you know, the trouble is, we used to, every Sunday in Orlando, in the park, where everyone goes and has picnics, we, the church, would go there and set up and have homeless vets come, and we would feed them. Never was a problem. We'd clean up, and you'd never know we were there. And about 4 hours later, we would go. They made that against the law. They told us if we give food to homeless vets, we will be arrested. And it didn't matter if it was a minister, anybody. Now, that's happening all across America. Another church that I would later talk with out in St. Louis said that when they were giving out blankets and finding a place for in a freezing night this past winter, they were warned by the police they would be arrested for helping a homeless person. In California, at Venice Beach, there was a guy who has a really nice RV, and he was told because he is homeless, his only possession is his RV, that he couldn't be there, even though he was in a proper legal space to park it, because he was homeless. Now, had he been a retired person going on a vacation, he could have been there as long as they wanted. So all across America now, I'm finding there's over 900,000 homeless vets, by the way. I'm finding that the vets are being given summonses and tickets and arrested, and then they have to have a veteran get them out, and then they can't get any of the services. And this is everywhere. Now, I just mentioned homeless vets because an awful lot of the people getting arrested and put in these positions don't have any money at all. They don't have a nickel. So how in the world, when you are arrested and you're put into a for-profit debtor's prison and you're going to be charged every day for the rotten food, then when you get out, you're going to be charged by the probation officer, but you can't pay the probation officer and you can't pay all these fees. How are you supposed to even survive? And yet I don't see this talked about anywhere. Now, I've given a lot of time to this, so please take your time and respond to anything I said.
Well, you are absolutely right that the criminalization of the homeless certainly is a big driver for the problem of debtors' prisons. And in fact, the criminalization of homelessness is only on the rise. There was a recent study done by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, which has been tracking about 187 cities around the country, looking at ordinances that apply to homelessness and criminalization of the homeless. And what the most recent study by the National Center found was that the numbers have been increasing recently. So, for example, the number of cities that prohibit sitting or lying in public spaces increased about 40% from 2011 to last year. In 2011, 37 cities banned sleeping in cars, and that jumped to 81 cities as of 2013, which is 120% increase. So it certainly is an increasing problem, and it's one that's not being addressed through the most cost-effective way, which is providing affordable housing. The affordable housing that's available is simply being overwhelmed by the number of homeless in this country. There are, of course, many some promising pilot programs where states and cities have been more thoughtful in their approach to long-term chronic homelessness, recognizing the severe costs, not just the human costs to the homeless, but the basic costs, public costs, that are caused by homelessness. There was a study done of a program in Charlotte, of a program called More Place, which is a program that houses chronically homeless adults, and found that through this program, through simply providing them with a steady home, a domicile, that the More Place saved the tenants close to $2 million a year in just healthcare costs. There also was close to an 80% drop in arrests of that population because they were off the street. And they attributed this huge drop again to a decrease in crimes related to homelessness, trespassing, loitering, public urination, begging, public consumption of alcohol. So again, you're talking about significant cost savings that can be assured through the provision of a steady home for the homeless. And again, you're absolutely right, that persons who end up in debtors' prisons, who end up in a cycle of getting in and out of jail multiple times because of a small fine, that with the addition of incarceration and pay-to-stay fees, the addition of private probation fees and handling fees, can become a lifetime debt. That instability worsens these men and women's credit ratings. It makes it more difficult for them to obtain steady employment. It makes it more difficult for them to obtain steady and stable housing. It's a massive disruption, and every month these men and women have to make extremely hard choices between paying their legal debts or buying food or paying their rent or paying their electricity bill. There also are some particularly insidious penalties that are placed upon the poor. For example, in Washington State, when you get a fine or a fee, you are subjected to a 12% interest rate under state law, which is close to usury, in my opinion. But that 12% rate, again, in the study that was done, sponsored by the Washington State Supreme Court, that 12% rate can turn what is a modest initial fine and fee into a lifetime debt. The Washington State Commission did a study on the effect of that interest penalty. It determined that the average defendant in Washington State who receives the average amount of fines and fees for a mid-level offense and who gets on a payment plan, which is typical in Washington State and elsewhere, and pays the typical amount per month towards that fine and fee, because of the operation of the interest rate, that person would still have an outstanding balance, would still be subject to rearrest for failing to pay 30 years after their conviction. So again, you're tethering these men and women to the criminal justice system in a way that puts them under constant threat of imprisonment and all the consequences of being imprisoned. So again, it is a serious problem. It's one that very few states have addressed, but some have, and some are beginning to take a careful look at these fines and fees and are beginning to reconsider whether it is truly worth it as an economic matter and whether as a matter of pure justice it makes sense to try to fund municipal and court operations on the back of the poorest of defendants who appear before them.
My last question is, do you have any evidence that groups such as the Koch Group, the Brothers, and their allies are involved in trying to push bills that would more firmly establish debtors' prisons at state levels?
We haven't carefully looked at that question. Again, it's something that certainly should be looked at carefully in terms of creating these perverse incentives. And you are correct, private probation companies and other private services certainly do profit quite a bit from debtors' prisons. So there certainly should be a question asked as to whether there should be a profit motive in any part of our criminal justice system. But certainly when it gives rise to debtors' prisons and all the attending costs that come with debtors' prisons.
I appreciate all the good work that you, Eric Balaban, and the ACLU and its National Prison Projects are doing to highlight debtor prisons in the United States, something that the average American, and especially those in gated communities and affluent neighborhoods, would never be exposed to, but a whole lot of Americans are. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. In this segment of our program, we're going to Arlington, Virginia for our Policing for Profit segment. This deals with asset forfeiture. My guest is Darpana Sheth. She is an attorney with the Institute for Justice, where she litigates cases to promote economic liberty and secure property rights. She's participated in trials against state government-imposed monopolies, constitutional challenges between government and medical device providers, and more recently, federal, state, and city forfeiture actions. She's currently the lead attorney on a federal class action against the City of Philadelphia and its law enforcement officials challenging the city's egregious civil forfeiture practices. Prior to joining the Institute for Justice, Darpana served as an assistant attorney general for the state of New York and as a law clerk to the Honorable Jerome Holmes of the U.S. State Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit. She graduated from the University of Pennsylvania with a baccalaureate in political science and received her law degree from Georgetown University Law Center. The Institute's website is lj.org, and more information on what people can do about asset forfeiture can be found on the website endforfeiture.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
I feel we need to make a distinction for listeners between criminal and civil forfeitures, because over 50% of forfeitures today are civil, and criminal forfeitures are more straightforward. A person is first convicted of a crime, and then forfeiture of property and personal value is carried out as a sentence, as a punitive action. However, civil forfeitures are a completely different matter, and there's a growing number of cases where citizens are having their properties, money, and valuables stolen from them by law enforcement for not having done anything wrong other than something occurring on their property that may have been illegal. And so please give us the details on the rationale for civil forfeitures, particularly since it's an action against property and not actual human beings in some cases, and is it's legal precedent, if any. And why do you believe we are now witnessing an increase in civil forfeiture actions in recent years?
Sure. Well, civil forfeiture is one of the greatest threats to property rights and due process in our nation today. And for exactly the reasons that you highlighted, it is distinct from criminal forfeiture, in which individuals must be convicted. Under civil forfeiture, it allows law enforcement officials to take your property without convicting or even charging you with a crime. And to make matters worse, law enforcement can auction off your property and pocket the proceeds from the sale, which really explains the explosion of civil forfeiture more recently. And as you stated, civil forfeiture is based on this legal fiction that property itself is guilty because it is suspected to be involved in a crime. And so the government files suit against the property, not the owner. And that's why civil forfeiture cases have unusual names like United States versus 434 Main Street or State of Texas versus 1-2004 Chevrolet. And because it is a civil proceeding, property owners are not guaranteed the constitutional protections that are afforded to criminal defendants, like the right to counsel.
I thank you. I appreciate that distinction. I was at an airport once in New York City at LaGuardia, and I was flying to Florida. I had my ticket, but there was a person in front of me who was purchasing a ticket. The person was just a regular person in a business suit, and next thing I know, that person is being asked to step aside. Now, I got my boarding pass. I was curious what was going on, and they took him aside, found out that he had paid by cash for his ticket, and wanted to know the source of the money and how much more cash he had. He turned over all the cash on him. I believe it was somewhere around $2,000. They kept it. even though I heard him explaining that he was on a business trip and this was just cash that he needed for the business trip. And they said, well, you'll have to go through Homeland Security and other departments to get it back. He wasn't charged with anything. He was allowed to get on the plane, but they just took his cash. Now, that's the first time I saw that. Then a friend of mine was driving from Florida to New York, got stopped in a small town, had done nothing wrong to get stopped, but this person is African-American, and they went through his car, trunk, but then they asked him to show him all of his valuables, any valuables at all, including his watch. And he had about $700, and they were going to confiscate that money, and he wanted to get on the phone with his attorney and argue this. And they say it doesn't matter who you argue with, you know, if you can't prove to us the source of that income. And he said, well, how am I supposed to prove it? You know, it's 10 o'clock at night. I can't call a bank. And hence, that was I thought I was shocked by that it was a rare occurrence. Now we see that over $1 billion, with a B, billion dollars, is in cash, is confiscated from drivers around the United States. And I'm telling my audience, if you have cash, a lot of cash, don't drive with it, because if you're pulled over, they can and frequently will take that cash. And even though you're not charged with anything, and now you have to go to court and fight to get it back. Tell us about that and how common that is and why they're doing this.
Right. Well, that's one of the real problems with civil forfeiture, that it turns the usual presumption of innocence, which is a hallmark of the American justice system, on its head. If you're a property owner, like you mentioned in your two specific examples, the burden is on you to prove that you're innocent. And that's very difficult to do, especially when you're trying to prove a negative. And so civil forfeiture really, it treats property owners worse than criminals for this reason, and because there is no right to an attorney, and it can take years to even get your day in court.
Many of the forfeiture laws originated during the Reagan and first Bush years and were connected with the war on drugs and as an economic means to fight organized crime. However, now there are cases where a family might have a teenager living under their roof who, unbeknownst to them, is using drugs, and then the family's home can be taken away from them. In other words, government departments, including police departments, are enriching themselves off the honest people who don't have the means or resources to fight the system. And today, minor drug busts, such as possession of small amounts of marijuana or drugs for private use, have become a means to fill our privatized prisons. Can you tie in civil forfeiture action to the war on drugs?
Yes. In fact, as you mentioned, the civil forfeiture just really started to explode at the federal government, law enforcement officials were allowed to keep forfeiture proceeds. And that really skyrocketed the amount of forfeiture revenues that were being taken in. Right now, the Department of Justice's Asset Forfeiture Fund, which is the largest of the federal programs in which that engage in civil forfeiture, and right now that's over $4 billion, all taken from forfeiture proceeds. And that happens also at the state level. So, for example, in Philadelphia, in the class action where the Institute for Justice is bringing now, Philadelphia has really turned civil forfeiture into a machine, and it's all fueled by this perverse profit incentive that underlies civil forfeiture, because most of the money all ends up going back to law enforcement officials. So, for example, from 2002 to 2012, the DA's office took over 1,000 homes, 3,200 cars, and over $44 million in cash from its citizens, many of whom were never even convicted of a crime. And all this money amounts to almost $6 million in forfeiture revenue each year for the city of Philadelphia. And that's more than twice the forfeiture revenue of Brooklyn, New York, and Los Angeles County combined. And the real telling story here is where all this money went. Over $25 million of it, which is almost 40%, went to pay salaries, including the salaries of the very prosecutors who wield tremendous amounts of discretion to bring these forfeiture actions in the first place. And so we really see that it's this perverse profit incentive that is fueling and driving civil forfeiture, both at the state and local level and also at the federal government.
Could you give us an example of a case in Philadelphia that might illustrate this more graphically to this audience?
Sure. Civil forfeiture laws exist all across the country. Philadelphia really is the ground zero for forfeiture abuse. One of the ways in which they've really departed from kind of the norm is they've been kicking people out of their homes without notice or an opportunity to go before a judge. So, for example, in Philadelphia, our lead plaintiff, Chris Suvarellis, first learned about civil forfeiture when police showed up at his home on his doorstep, and his wife was there at the time and basically told her that they had to leave, pack up their belongings and leave because their home was subject to forfeiture and they could talk to a judge in about a week, but in the meantime, they had to be kicked out of their home. And this was all because a month before that, their son was arrested for illegal drug activity outside the home. He was selling $40 worth of drugs outside the home. And so, you know, imagine police showing up to your house and just kicking you out, and you have no notice of this. So they went eventually, Mr. and Mrs. Suvarellis, to the court. They were told to go to courtroom 478, only to find out that that's not even a courtroom at all. There's no judge. There's no jury. There's not even a court reporter to transcribe these so-called hearings. Instead, it's really the city's prosecutors who run the courtroom and call all the shots. It's the prosecutors who frequently tell owners who ask for a lawyer that the process is simple and a lawyer is not necessary, and it's the prosecutors who order property owners to come back to courtroom 478 time and time again. So this is just the most egregious example in Philadelphia, but this kind of thing happens with civil forfeiture all across the country.
There's also one other case that comes to mind in Michigan of a man who was busted for a meeting with a prostitute in a car that was owned by his wife. But the courts upheld that since the car was guilty, the wife, who was innocent, could not get her car back.
Right, and that is a real travesty of justice. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a case known as Bennis v. Michigan, held that the Constitution does not require what's called an innocent owner defense, so that innocent people, like Bennis's wife in that case, who didn't know of the illegal activity and certainly didn't consent to it, can lose their property, and that's not a violation of the federal Constitution. Thankfully, a lot of states have enacted innocent owner provisions so that at the state level there are protections for innocent owners, but as I mentioned earlier, it really turns the burden on its head, or the presumption of innocence on its head, so that property owners have to come to court and prove that they are innocent, rather than the government proving that they're guilty. And as I mentioned before, too, they don't have the right to counsel, so you have to pay for an attorney, come to court and prove your innocence, and a lot of times the property at stake is just not equal to the cost that one would incur to fight and contest the civil forfeiture.
Does the government ruling of eminent domain fit at all into the civil forfeiture epidemic now underway?
Not directly, but I think it's a symptom of a larger problem of the U.S. Supreme Court's lack of respect and judicial engagement in what the Fifth Amendment and property rights mean under the U.S. Constitution. And it's really time to start changing that so that the courts all across the country, and as well as even at the legislative level, can start reforming laws and protecting property rights and due process under the Constitution.
A sizable percentage of our listeners now are in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, even though this program is heard worldwide in 166 countries. How bad are these states, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, in the civil forfeiture policies and actions?
I think most of these states are pretty bad. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure where they rank. I think the Institute for Justice had published a landmark study that evaluated each state's forfeiture laws and graded them based on along three components. One is what the burden of proof is on the government to show that a property is subject to forfeiture, and another is what the burden is on property owners. Like, does the statute flip the burden so that property owners have to affirmatively prove their innocence? And finally, states were graded on where the money goes. Under the federal government and a large majority of states, it's the law enforcement officials, so the very people charged with seizing the property and then eventually bringing the forfeiture action, that get the benefit of the forfeiture proceeds. So it's an entire stream of revenue, if you will, for a lot of states. So I think in New York, for example, they had a final grade of D.
That's not
based
good.
On these. No, it's not good.
Here's my deepest concern. Asset forfeitures are turning into a business as a means to fund cities and police departments. And in a federal forfeiture case, either the Department of Justice, as you mentioned, or Department of Treasury. Now, the latest figures I had were from the Department of Justice that they had, as you mentioned, over $4 billion in forfeitures, $2.5 billion worth of confiscated property. And these are then sold at auctions or to the private sector in order to maximize net returns. Could you elaborate on the financial incentive that civil forfeitures provides, and then why we should be deeply concerned, because it has the potential to victimize practically every citizen with the loss of their homes, their accounts, and other properties? And these are the types of actions that were common among the ORPO and crypto police departments under the Nazi Third Regime. And isn't this, in principle, state-sanctioned thievery? And how can you assess civil forfeiture from a constitutional point of view? You touched upon that earlier, but I'd like for you to emphasize it again.
Sure. And in fact, that's exactly what a Pennsylvania judge characterized civil forfeiture as, nothing more than state-sanctioned theft. And that's because civil forfeiture really lures law enforcement away from the impartial pursuit of justice toward what IJ has termed policing for profit. Law enforcement officials should not be allowed to keep and spend what they forfeit, and no American should lose his or her property without being convicted of a crime. And when you put those two things together, it's very clear that civil forfeiture is unconstitutional. On the one hand, we're taking people's property, and unlike in eminent domain, they're not even being compensated for it, and they're not charged, they're not convicted, and they're much less even charged with a crime. And on the other hand, there's no due process, because the forfeiture officials, so the seizing agencies or the prosecutors, have a direct financial incentive to, in the outcome of that forfeiture proceeding, which skews their ability to fairly enforce the law. I mean, it would be like police officers getting a certain percentage of every traffic ticket that they write. And, of course, that's going to incentivize writing more traffic tickets, regardless of whether there's actually a violation or not. And the Supreme Court and the has a line of cases that interpret due process under the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution as meaning that you are guaranteed an impartial arbiter in any action. So you can't go before a judge, and if that judge has a financial stake in the outcome of the proceeding, well, that's not really due process. And here you've got the prosecutors and the people who are bringing the forfeiture action, as well as the law enforcement officials on the ground making that determination to seize the property in the first place, having a direct financial incentive in that property. And all of that is unconstitutional.
Appreciate those insights. My final question deals with who is most likely to be victimized. Do we see this proportional and equal among those who are poor, those who are minorities, as the same rate that we would find affluent neighborhoods, affluent people, affluent drivers, business people? Is it more or less the same, or is it biased towards one group or one class of people in our society?
I think, unfortunately, it is disproportionately affecting those of lesser income and minorities. Those who are more affluent certainly have resources to hire counsel and maybe fight forfeiture, but because it's a civil proceeding, people are not guaranteed the right to counsel, and unless they have pro bono assistance, like from the Institute for Justice, they would have to hire an attorney, and legal fees just really mount up in defending one of these actions. For example, the Institute for Justice represented a family-run motel up in Tewksbury, Massachusetts, and at one point before IJ got involved in defending this piece of property from Russ Caswell, he had considered settling maybe because on the one hand he risked, you know, spending all this money with his counsel, or you know, losing his entire motel, which at the time was worth $1.5 million. Thankfully, he was able to obtain pro bono assistance from the Institute for Justice, and he was able to fight the forfeiture action brought by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Massachusetts. And it was only after 5 years of litigation and finally a trial that the Institute for Justice was able to save his property from forfeiture.
What can we, the people, do to challenge this?
Well, you can visit our website at endforfeiture.com to learn more about how this affects you know, what the laws are in your state, as well as different cases that IJ has litigated, and more importantly, to sign up for any sort of petition or legislative reform and contact state and local officials, as well as their representatives in Congress. It's really time that these laws be changed, and it would be helpful if that came from the people.
I appreciate all that your organization is doing. You're at the forefront of this, and for all of us, we thank you for your efforts. And the website is, the Institute of Justice website is ij.org. And to end forfeitures, get information from endforfeitures.com. Thank you very much for being with us today, Darpana Sheth. We appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much, Gary. It was a pleasure to be on your show.
I'm Gary Knoll. This brings up the end of this particular program on our Police State series, Policing for Profits and Asset Forfeitures. Have a nice day.